views and opinions expressed by callers, guests, and hosts do not necessarily reflect those of the Black Talk Radio Network and Black Talk Media Project. Black Talk Radio is new black media for the new millennium.
Special evening, we have the co-host of Race Treaty, Anaji Moued, who's really going to give some insight into his travels that have been really widespread over this last year and his development as relates to human rights and the decade. Anaji, are you there this evening? Okay.
Good evening, Robin.
Good evening. Good evening. Long time since we've spoken, Anaji, and been on air together. Are you unmuted? I'm really, really eager to deal with some of the issues surrounding where we're at with the decade. You've got some great announcements and some developments that have been underway as relates to the decade. Anaji, are you there?
I am here. Yes, I am.
Well, pipe in, brother. To give some background, let's formalize it a little bit this evening. I really want everyone to understand that reparations is an underlying theme on our human rights mission in life and in terms of identity in this country. You've got a book coming out, the reparations imperative, I understand, due out perhaps this May or this coming spring as a tribute to Malcolm X. Can you speak on that?
Well, the book is entitled Decolonizing Social Work, The Okay. Reparations Imperative. And the title came into being largely because of the students at Columbia University where I teach. The students have organized and have been consistent in their demands of making the education process relevant to their realities as well as to their goals and aspirations. And as a result of that, the students have forced the administration to change the framing of social work to that of decolonizing social work. We are in our first, actually moving into our second semester under this banner and under this theme, and I'm quite honored and proud of these students who have done that. And as a professor, I am teaching a few of the courses that the first courses that will in fact have this theme. And I had another title for my book, which was called Return to the Source, a premiere on transformative social work, but the students actually pulled my coat and helped me to see that a more inclusive and a broader term would be better suited by using the theme that they in fact have created. And I don't know of any other social work school in the country that has actually broken the ice. When I say broken the ice, I'm talking about the mask that is used. Race is used as a mask upon which, as an instrument to really subjugate a nation. We have a lot of confusion about the words we use, and that's how people remain oppressed. That is, if you can make a people mystified, if you can make them dependent and subordinate, as well as powerless, then you've colonized that people, that group. This is the definition that was supplied to us by the ancestor Maury Evans that I use often because it's very, very crisp, very sharp, and very poignant. So our work is that about the demystification, which is really around the language and the words that we use, and probably one of the biggest concepts that we're confused about is that of nation. I'm going to refer to another ancestor, Imari Obadeli. And he writes that, what is a nation? What is a state? In common conversation, we often use the words nation and state as if these entities were synonymous. They are not. Yet even Supreme Court Justice Thompson of the distinguished and groundbreaking court of Chief Justin John Marshall, writing his dissent in the landmark case of 1831 against the Cherokee Nation versus the state of Georgia, and relying on international law scholar Vattel, he writes, the term state and nation are used in the law of nations, as well as in common parlance, as importing the same thing, and apply a body of men united together to procure their mutual safety and advantage by means of this union. Such a society has its affairs and interests to manage. It deliberates and takes resolutions in common, and thus becomes a moral person, having an understanding and a will particular to itself, and is susceptible to obligations and laws. Then he goes on to say that the today, 150 years later, definitions in American law delimiting states and nations are precise. The Montevideo Treaty, the Convention on the Rights and Duties of States, done in Montevideo, Uruguay, in 1933, states that the characteristics of a permanent a nation is a permanent population, a defined territory, a government, and for independent states, and the capacity. This is the definition of states. Let me go back. I'm confusing it right here. I better read the thing the way it's written. Okay, he says, today, 150 years later, definitions in American law defining states and nations are more precise. The Montevideo Treaty, the Convention on the Rights and Duties of States, done in Montevideo, Uruguay, in 1933, and ratified by the United States in 1934, defined state as having three major characteristics, with a fourth major characteristic for independent states. Okay, this is to say, of course, that all states are not fully independent. These characteristics are a permanent population, defined territory, a government, and for capacity to enter into relationship with other states. So a nation is really a body of people. And if you can take away the idea that you are a group, you are a body, then people will treat you as individuals. And this is the problems that we have. So when we talk about demystification, we're really talking about the harm that comes from not seeing ourselves as a nation, as a group. So it's really important to educate our people around this. Why? Because then if you declare yourself as a nation, you have two possibilities. One is called the National Minority by Yusuf Clyde, who's done a tremendous amount of work on that, of which he was the chair of the Organization of African American Unity that was founded by Malcolm X, of course. And in his NGO, non-governmental organization, ICRAM, International Human Rights for American Minorities, he uses the national minority international law aspect to talk about the group. In a way, it doesn't really matter much which one we use at this point. The question is, how do we organize the people to actually get to a certain point? And that organization very well can come through the international decade for people of African descent, 2015 to 2024. And that is under the themes of recognition, justice, and development.
Beautifully said. Anaji, we've spoken on this program, Scotty included, about this issue of nation within a nation and identity issue.
Let me stop if I can for a minute. It's not a nation within a nation. You see, it's a nation within a multinational state. So when you say nation within a nation, it's almost saying that nation and states are the same thing. They're different. The United States is not a nation. It's a multinational state. And because you have, because they have obfuscated the made invisible the state apparatus by using the word nation, you see, that takes away the political structure. And in so doing, people's rights are automatically taken away because it's like you don't exist. You know, there was a book called The Invisible Man. Well, we're really talking about the invisible nation. We're here as a nation, but we don't have, we haven't organized ourselves as such, and we don't have the rights that should be accorded, but we have to fight for those rights. They aren't something that's going to just come out of the sky. It's something that we have to actually fight for.
When you say fight for, you know, not to interject on the negative, but I don't see any remedy inside the civil rights framework. And the human rights seems to be toothless in the sense that there's no enforcement into all the violations the United States continues to perpetrate, even on its own populations. So we do have to fight, and we do have to organize, but we also have to come to grips with some identity processes as a people, because until we get to the international arena and deal with our issues there under a human rights identity, under international law, I think we're going to keep coming up short, keep running into the wall of white supremacy, because to me, civil rights is part of the framework of white supremacy. And there's no accountability, no compliance by the United States to treaties that it has signed. And I'm speaking specifically about CERD. So I want you to speak to, because brother, you've been on the path of reparations. You've been on this path a long time. People don't understand your background as raised in Cobra and your recent trip to Geneva. We need a report back this evening on that. And also you have a declaration to share with us concerning the decade and a declaration being promulgated concerning that. So to stay on point, Anaisi, can you take this show and lead it to those information points that we need to share with the audience tonight?
Well, I'll try to do that. And state them again so I can be on point.
Well, let's start with your travels, this culminating now, the Geneva feedback on your recent trip dealing with the working group from the United Nations on CERD, the Convention to Eliminate Racial Discrimination. That in itself is a major report. And I'd like really you to update us on the intent behind the decade to begin to seriously organize globally, as is our first really opportunity to organize some framework that can continue to exist, as right now we're seeking justice, but right now we have to understand recognition and what that encompasses. And you've been at the table in terms of the decade of those of African descent. Can you give us some insight as to where we're at and some of your feelings? You seem to have some excitement about the prospect of us actually carrying out this organizing process for the decade.
Well, there's been four United Nations conferences on racism. The first one was in 1978 that was looking at South Africa. So we have been speaking about race and racism in different ways, but the one that really stood out is the third one, which was in 2001. There in Durban, South Africa, of which I was a delegate, many people came from all over the world, across the globe, to demand reparations and demand that slavery become a crime against humanity, which it was. And many people don't understand the significance of that. In international law, war crimes, genocide, crimes against humanity. These are the major crimes that the world has seen as being, you know, above and beyond anything horrendous. So for slavery to be declared a crime against humanity is saying finally, and that's what the Declaration said, they said it should have always have been declared a crime against humanity. And they go on and detail the consequences of slavery. And because that's have been put on the table, it gives us a different way of looking at world history. Because now we can place in columns those nations who were the perpetrators of the crime, and we can place in perspective those nations and peoples that became victims of the crime. And when you have that type of formula, it moves to the question of repair. First, what's the harm, and what should be the repair? And the repair is reparations. So we see a trend that has been building really ever since our people have been here in this monstrosity called the United States of America. But the trend is building to finally move the conversation from 125th Street on the corner to 47th Street. That is, move it down into the United Nations. And now it's starting to filter through the various organs of the United Nations, particularly the Commission of on Human Rights, which is located in Geneva. You really can't disconnect 47th Street, the headquarters of the United Nations, from its human rights base in Geneva, Switzerland. So my trip to Geneva, Switzerland last month in November, I guess that's 2 months ago now since January, was to participate with many non-governmental organizations around the world, as well people of African descent, as well as nation states. Nation states sit up front closer to the panel, the chair of the particular meeting, and then the NGOs sit behind them. So it was both state representatives there as well as representatives from non-governmental organizations, NGOs. I'm the NGO representative for ICHLAM, the International Human Rights Association for American Minorities, and my task was to deliver the intervention that we had comprised prior to my departure. And at that meeting, what we discovered is the evidence of a worldwide system of racism. It was almost bewildering to hear all the people of African descent around the world saying exactly the same thing, talking about their health, which is below par, talking about the over-representation in prisons, talking about an education system where they're not recognized, their history is not taught, and whatever is presented is erroneous and negative. And they talked about economics, right? The poverty that people are experiencing throughout the world, because as we can remember, during the period of colonialism, starting in 1885 with the Berlin Conference, European powers decided to carve up Africa like a cake, and so doing, create false boundaries, dividing different, you know, cultural groups, and then having them fight amongst themselves. So Africa is suffering from external determination of forced oppression in terms of these false boundaries, and they're still trying to rectify something that took place back in 1885. So, not in the period of decolonization, of saying how do we begin to bring these different elements together, and even though there were many African people there in terms of people from literally from, who were born and lived in Africa, in addition to those who are called people of African descent, and there was opposition to the term. It's like, no, you know, you don't talk about Europeans as being, you know, European people of European descent. So people objected to the term. So there were a lot of points that, again, went to the demystification aspect of oppression so that people can start to be on the same page. So it was eye-opening. It was dreadful to hear the state of our people around the world, but at the same time, it was very uplifting. It was uplifting because it gave us a chance to meet each other, people who speak Portuguese, people who speak English, people who speak French, people, of course, who speak Spanish, and, of course, people who speak English. So it was a place where we had a chance to come together, as we did in Durban in 2001, and compare notes. The thing which was most impressive about that gathering was that there were many young people from, again, across the globe. And one person in particular, I was phenomenally, you know, proud of. This is a sister from the Virgin Islands, where her intervention spoke to the fact that our people, in fact, are a colony of the United States. And you don't really hear too much of that type of thinking, and certainly you don't see it broadcast in any type of public arenas. And for the most part, the United Nations is a place for public opinion. Yes, you know, treaties are made and conventions are made, but it doesn't really have any teeth to do anything. The thing to be done is organizing people that will bring pressure on different municipalities and different states so that certain changes can happen. But you have to first begin with speaking about it. You have to first begin to win public opinion about the right to self-determination. So with the young people there at the conference, the level of accuracy and political astute that they showed, it's a reason for much hope and inspiration.
And Najee, I'm moved by your participation and the information you're sharing. And when you said that you heard around the circles and around the table globally the same exact complaints or the same exact issues dealing with economics, I was hearing you speak of the nine areas of people activity and speaking to the human rights report that we were involved with the state of Black Asheville. But what brought to my mind was recognition involves information, and not only verbal exchange, but the data issue. The data is out there now, and it hasn't been compiled to hold the country into accountability. The number of police killings in this country is not the duty of the U.S. government. It seems it's the duty of the Guardian newspaper in London to compile the data of the police killings. So we have a real issue about recognition as relates to metadata and aggregating data to tell our story in all the areas of people activity. And so I'm really looking forward to that formula being exercised around the world. We are in the recognition stage of the decade. Are there some projected goals coming out of that recognition point that we're at right now?
Well, of course, the first recognition is to be recognized as human beings. Once you create a category, a hierarchy that looks at some people as being human, other people as non-human, of course, then that gives you the rationale to treat them in a non-human way. So the first recognition is that of being recognized as human, right? Being human, and with that recognition, entitles us to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which are 30 articles that talks about different ways in which people experience their existence on the planet inside of a nation state or a multinational state in our case. And once you recognize the Universal Declaration, then it goes on to recognizing the other treaties that's associated with various peoples. And you had asked the question, you know, what's the projection? The projection is that Just recently, the United Nations has announced the aim to create a declaration for people of African descent. We have to understand this is huge. See, you can't kidnap a people, torture them, hold them in bondage for 500 years and say that they're citizens. You can't confer citizenship on any people. But this is what has happened to us. Which means that we have to say if we accept. You can offer citizenship, but you can't confer it. And because we haven't had a full education about what human rights are, and particularly in terms of international law, our people are thinking that they can have their problems solved through civil rights. They can't, and they'll never will. Only until we develop the consciousness and the commitment to assert our rights, in legal terms, it's called jus auditor. You have to assert your rights for them to be actually acknowledged. So we have to develop the consciousness and the commitment to see ourselves as a unique entity. Queen Mother Randall has started a group called Descendants of Africans in the United States. Yes. That's a very interesting term because it's starting to talk about this thing of group rights. That is the key that we have to hold on to, group rights. Now it's a handle, and people are trying to hold on to it at different places. One place is looking at ourselves as a Republic of New Africa. Another part of the handle is looking at us as a national minority. Another handle is Deus. It doesn't matter. Once we have the consciousness that we demand a plebiscite, we demand, and this is what we have to say to the world, that we demand an international supervised plebiscite that's going to say what we want to be, what relationship we want to be to this in this country. Until that happens, only thing we'll do is just chase our tails. Because if you go to court, the first thing they ask the court will say, well, do you have standing, right? Do you have a right to be here, right? So the first thing we have to is get international standing. But you only get a national standing when you show the political maturity that you understand how the world works. In absence of that knowledge, you'll be treated like a political child. That's how we're being treated, because that's how we're thinking. That's why Malcolm X is so important, because Malcolm said, we demand our rights. We declare our rights on this earth to be a human being, to be respected as a human being, to be given the rights of a human being in this society, on this earth, in this day, which we intend to bring into existence by any means necessary. A very famous quote of Malcolm X. So we have to continue in that vein of educating our people about what rights we have, divine rights, not just human rights, but divine rights. And as we do that, the world will respond to us. There are people waiting around the world to respond to us, but they are in a position where they can't do anything until we first declare ourselves a people, declare ourselves a nation, and then begin as any other people who have been captive by any other nation state, until we begin a liberation process for our freedom and for our self-determination.
Beautifully spoken. We're reaching the halfway point of our show this evening, but Najee, you spoke on some points that I'd like to respond to also, in that there's multiple fronts on this lawfare and referencing this international law and these international bodies. That's a long way from the grassroots folks, and okay, we'll take a break at 10. That's a long way from the grassroots folks, Najee. And these delegations and activities on the UN referencing international law, it's hard for people to localize, internalize these international laws that don't seem to represent them. And that's speaking to human rights. Now, you've been involved in a mechanism, because when we say they, or what we have to do way out there, what can we do where we're at? And speaking to that, you're involved with a human rights city campaign with, we know, Jackson, Mississippi being the case study. It's the motto. It's our hope right now as we watch it, you know, process, and brothers are down there doing great things. However, this human rights report could be generated in every city to see the picture of how our folks are faring in all these areas of people activity. This is the process is local. So how do we come out of the ivory towers, the academic circles, to the grassroots? And what can folks on a local level do internationally? Well, they can do something internationally, locally, in confronting and dealing with municipal law and bringing international laws to the local grassroots setting through ordinances, because there are three legal mechanisms as of now that aren't really being used to represent our people, and that's the Constitution, treaties which are violated or not adhered to, and municipal law. Now, you know, example being when Bree Newsom brought down that flag and whatnot, North Carolina had promulgated new ordinances or stop ordinances on a municipal level. So there's power in creating control on a grassroots level in the city councils, imposing lawfare, you know, with a strategy to impose human rights as a basis for our petitions, our legal base surrounding most of our organizing and complaints. But I do believe, you know, when I hear you speaking about what we can do globally, it seems so far away. So what can we do where we're at? And you're involved with that local organizing process with the Human Rights City campaign in Jackson. Can you speak to that?
Well, there have been around the world a number of places where they are saying that they can't and they won't depend upon the state apparatus to enforce or to sign or to ratify any of the international human rights law documents that would give them a greater status, right? It's called equal status. So rather than wait, not even wait, but rather than depend upon that process, and it's going to happen at some point in time, but in the meantime, you start where you're at. You know, of course, we're familiar with the phrase, think, you know, globally, but act locally. So locally, we can galvanize the power that we have in our numbers and begin to run for offices in local places. And if not, at least say to folks, if you want my vote, these are the demands that I have for you to do. We can look at Chicago as an example. Chicago, for a number of years, have been kidnapping people. The police officers, the police officers in Chicago have been kidnapping people, torturing them in warehouses, and unbeknownst to the public. Once people were finally released, it was lawyer Brother Willis, who was attempting to get these police officers arrested and tried and convicted. But without much success, he was able to actually go to the Hague International Court, bring that information forward, and was able to get the results of a number of police officers who were, in fact, arrested, tried, and convicted. So we're not disconnected.
There's more to that story also, brother. There was the first time when they used the language from the torture convention from international law, the city council made an ordinance, made a decision on a local legal level, not through a court civil rights lawsuit, but through an ordinance where they gave the victims of Holman Square $5.5 million, which was a first-time precedent utilizing the language of the torture convention. So a precedent has been established where municipal laws, city councils, local ordinances can be promulgated and developed to exercise and represent international law. So that's to me was major and still is major. But in order for us to aggregate that data to recognize the problems in all these areas seems overwhelming unless you put on the human rights lens. You see each and one of these, each and every one of these violations of human rights law leaves us rudderless out there to navigate, you know, the legal process to try to gain remedy. We can get it if we start pushing on a local level with this Human Rights Cities campaign. So I think it's really a major thing that happened in Chicago that you're speaking to. And you may want to speak to Sister Willis also in the fact that they're carrying on the Human Rights City organizing, and that people around this country can call in and become involved and try to get an apparatus set up where they are locally to organize around, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, the point, you know, was two sides of the coin I was pointing to. Thank you for bringing me to the other side of the coin. One coin was that how you can use international bodies to bring public opinion that can change a state. But you mentioned that local ordinance. In the National Human Rights Cities Alliance is a group of individuals who are now organizing throughout the country in the various cities to do what Chicago did. Chicago, in fact, adopted the Convention on the Child. And of course, in there saying children can't be tortured, they can't be placed in solitary confinement, you can't try someone under 18 as an adult. All the different things which are happening to our children, you see, would be declared illegal under such a convention on a national level, but the city of Chicago has in fact adopted that as local legislation. So all the
I want to also interject that the United States is the only country in the global world body that has not signed the International Treaty to Protect Children. So that should be recognized also by our audience in terms of adhering to human rights. But the United States refuses to recognize that convention as a major convention under human rights international law. So to have it done locally and grasp onto that international law locally is our only avenue, because the United States has not recognized that convention and the only country in the world that has not signed it.
Right, because they know it wouldn't allow them the legal right to do what they have been doing, which is kidnapping our people and placing them into these death camps. Rikers Island, it's a big movement taken underfoot now to close Rikers Island, which is the biggest penal colony in the world. So the people are organizing. We just don't have a communication vehicle to express the level of work that's being done, and that's the importance of this program. Race Treaty is not only here to give information. Race Treaty is here to give these organizers a platform, one, to speak to their constituency, two, to speak to their community, and three, to speak to other different forefronts where this type of work is taking place. So the National Human Rights Cities Alliance is coordinating that. I just finished coming back from Atlanta, Georgia, being a delegate to the United States Human Rights Network, a network. I forget about how many years they've been in existence, but now they have really upped the ante as well. They have used the conference as a way to recognize indigenous people as sovereign nations, and in so doing, now have elevated the human rights struggle and conversation such that now this what's going to come next is that education amongst all the participants, those that were there and those who were members of the network that weren't there, about how we need to create these nation-to-nation relationships. Somebody asked me a question, what do I think the answer is? I would say, listen, you got the land and we got the numbers. You have more land than we have, but we have more people than you have. So if we are able to forge functional unity about common interests, which of course is the life and the well-being of our peoples, then we'll come up with a solution. So we find ourselves, I think, in a situation of forced interdependence that will work to our advantage when we decide to come together as we did. We had a number of indigenous nations at that conference, and that might have been the first time. I've been to like maybe one or two of their conferences, but nothing as fundamental, as significant as the one that was held in Atlanta, Georgia. It was like the first week in December, I think from the 6th to the 10th, something of that sort. So we see these movements are coming together, finding common ground. The National Human Rights Cities Alliance was present doing some workshops at this conference. And of course, we had groups representing political prisoners. Many of our prisoners have been languishing in these jails for over 50 years now, which is a crime against humanity. And we're saying, send them home. If they're no, threat, to civil society, then they have a right to be paroled and to be sent home.
And Najee,
yes,
we have a deeper feeling concerning the prisoner issue. And political prisoners, one, but the school to prison pipeline is the commodifying of black bodies as an industry revenue, and it's been privatized, and we are commodified. Our bodies have been commodified. That's why the U.S. has not signed on to the Convention to Protect Children, because they're in violation as we speak. And I want to get to this one real quick point, which is we want to send them to send us home. We really want them to close the doors, because what they're involved with is a continuation of slavery under the 13th Amendment, and we still lend a blind eye to that. And I want to speak to that really in the sense that as there's all these movements to do amendments on the Constitution, we have an amendment that has basically institutionalized slavery in another morphed fashion.
It's just morphed. Slavery has never left. What's the purpose of slavery? Slavery was the control of population for the exploitation of their labor. And all these prisons have, work that's all the corporations outside of prison are going in using the prisoners for cheap labor. So they've found a way to remove themselves from the responsibility for caring for these captive workers, moving further away from the responsibility they have for them, but still having the fundamental relationship of marginalization, exploitation, domination, or the exploitation of their labor. And we can see that from chattel slavery all the way up into modern day slavery. It's the same system, but they just changed the name, but the fundamental relationship remains the same. Like you said, the codification of black bodies.
Yes. We're going to take a pause with that. Think about it. Our existence in this country has been about commodifying the black body, the black mind, the black spirit, black culture, the black ethos. It's been without the appropriation of our being, we probably don't have any value at all. Now, brother man, you have really been involved in trauma. As we speak to what is now science, intergenerational trauma in the DNA, we're speaking of disparate impact in terms of international law, language concerning slavery, there are victims. So you need to recognize that also. And part of that recognition is, again, compiling the data to tell the story. I'd like you to speak also about that aspect, because you're deeply involved in trauma. You've done a path this past year that I've seen. You're a sun dancer. You're a yogi. You've gone to retreats, silent retreats. You've gone to meditative retreats. You've put a lot of spirituality into this process. And you recognize that healing is like wanting. We're in want of healing. And yet we have to recognize, like they say in the 12 steps, the first step towards recovery is getting past denial. And so can you speak to that as part of your organizing being and goals also as relates to trauma, not from a therapeutic, clinical, social work perspective, in your path?
We had a pretty interesting nexus in terms of various things coming together all at the same time. In the last maybe 15 years or so, the science of epigenetics, which is the study of heritable changes in gene expression that do not involve changes to the underlying DNA sequence, a change in the phenotype without a change in the genotype, which turns on and turns off different cells. We come into the world with a certain DNA structure and potentials to do this or to that, given what we've inherited. But these genes are turned on or turned off by the environment in which we live that will say what's going to really happen. So more and more evidence are being presented to show that if you traumatize an embryo, if you traumatize a fetus in vitro, when that fetus actually comes into full fruition, as it's going to come into the world with a certain kind of predisposition. And that predisposition is going to compromise the ability to go through what is called stages of development. You said, don't use social work stuff. I can't help it. You know, it's just part of how I think. So as a result of this, there have been one of the most popular studies is called Adverse Childhood ACEs, Adverse Childhood Experiences, that kind of came into existence almost by accident. A managed care organization out in California was actually studying obesity, and they were able to assist a number of individuals quite successfully and moving out of the state of obesity down to normal weight. And what happened is that there was a ricochet effect where the people wound up gaining the weight back, you know, just as quickly as it took them to actually lose it. In fact, even quicker. And they had to go back and start to say, well, why is this? You know, we've put all these wonderful protocols together. You know, it's evidence-based. And what happened? Well, what they found out that they were able to show that there were about 12 different indicators that if you had any one or any combination of those indicators, they could very accurately predict if you were going to have heart failure, if you were going to have renal failure, if you were going to use drugs, so forth and so on. And that became just a phenomenal discovery, because we're talking about a basically white middle class population. So if you can make that type of scientific correlation with groups which are considered to be the cream of the crop, or at least experiencing the best that life has to have here in the United States, we can only imagine what that study would have been if they would have studied us. So as a result of that, you are hearing more and more trauma-informed systems, right? Trauma-informed systems in terms of schooling, trauma-informed systems in terms of substance abuse and mental health. So there is a sweeping paradigm across many disciplines in terms of now looking at the person, looking at the experience, and seeing how trauma is involved. Now, for us, this becomes very important because we have and have always claimed, you know, the dreadful treatment that our people have experienced. And now with the science of epigenetics, and now with people understanding what is called the social determinants of health, how the environment, you know, impacts one's mental, physical, and spiritual health, we can now show over time how racism is killing us, right? Many studies are coming out in the field of public health, in the field of genetics, in the field of sociology. So we had a time where different branches of information is coming together to really show the harm. Now, once you have harm, that means a crime has been committed. Once you are able to exact the crime, then there must be a criminal who's actually perpetrating this type of treatment. And then also you can therefore define the victim of this crime. So it's given us more information in terms of building our case for reparations. It's not just here in the United States. People in the Caribbean, many in the Caribbean states, have also started to organize this question. So it's going to happen. The only question is really, how persistent will we remain in that struggle for reparations? Because we can go all the way back to Cali House Dickerson, you know, who formed an organization that said, okay, since you didn't give us money when you made us work as slaves, then we're at least, you know, entitled to a pension. So the reparations movement has been around for many, many years. It just hasn't found its way in the public domain. And I had, as we started off early in the program, the fact that the students at Columbia University have said we want a decolonizing social work framework is now creating the platform for these types of discussions where they have not been welcomed, in fact, been shunned, because in policy it says social policy is defined by the policymakers. Well, who came up with that idea, right, other than the colonizers themselves? So we're saying, no, we want to define what's important to us. And what's important to us is a repair of the harm that you have caused against us. And now we are starting to use these institutions, these minds, to bring forth those arguments and for the purpose of organizing the people to bring pressure, a demand. We're not asking for reparations, we're demanding it, but the people themselves have to be in a position that they could actually exact, you know, some type of price from those who don't want to listen. And, you know, that's why strike and why unions are so important. Unions are vital because they are in right in the middle of the means of production, and that's why organizing with the unions is so important.
Can I bring us back on track on terms of the social workers? Because a couple of red flags went up for me, brother man. I have to say, in that you speak to the mind sciences and social workers, and that they're yielding to the policymakers. In reality, social workers are in fact the gatekeepers of services that are delivered to the in need populations on a lot of levels, and. And speaking to that, social works also have not yet, and there was a conference some years ago, Sandy was part of organizing that, to create a competency in terms of racial equity lens and understanding how that cultural bridge and white supremacy affects, as you say, traumatized populations. So that lens, that competency hasn't been established in that field yet. And there's really what's critical in that field is that the social workers have to make a decision about who their constituency and accountability is to either the policymakers in their coded language and the monies that goes and generates. Because there's another red flag, and that is the United States government, the veterans, the VA is the largest employer of social workers now, is the government. And which speaks also to two more points, which is that the psychological services were found complicit in architecturing, being involved in the architect of the torture report as an industry. And as a tertiary issue concerning that, the power of a DSM can redirect someone's life by a diagnosis, which most MSWs can make, which is the diagnostic manual. In that manual, they're revealing the traumatized populations and the neurosis attached through internalized inferiority, internalized oppression. But at the same time, the control of the narrative still exists in the fact that there has never been the study and promulgated as a DSM neurosis, and that is the white supremacist mask of internalized superiority with all the, you know, added defaults that are involved there. So I'm saying there's critical even to the field that you're involved with, how you can take a lead in organizing there amongst social workers. But I don't see the fix. I see a fix is in if we don't take control. It's a critical stage for that industry as well. And I shouldn't say an industry, but I should say that field. You know, and you are a leader yourself, and you can see both sides of that. I'm just bringing to mind from a critical analysis that, you know, in dealing with the social work industry, that there's a lot of very ignorant, well-meaning white folks or people involved in that field that really don't have a grasp and do hold to the policies that are driving the same outcomes, which is really statistically oppression on our people. So I wanted to call that into effect too, Brother Matt.
Yeah, well, Robin, you know, it's you know, much of our, you know, I'll go back to Damari Evans, you know, formula. You know, if you make a people mystified, dependent, subordinate, and powerless, mm-hmm. you got colonized them. So decolonization will always begin with the first level, which is demystification, which is being able to explain, help people see the world in the way that it is, you know, through what is called popular education. So I don't want to minimize the fact that the students have fought for this victory and they've won it. And by no means am I defending the field of social work. I'm saying that anywhere you are, in whatever profession that you're in, you know, it's your responsibility to raise those contradictions and push to have that particular profession live up to ethical codes that it has established. It's called internal criticism. That's by Dr. Jones, who talks about internal criticism.
Racism in the workplace.
Exactly. So we go
on that often also. That dynamic is across the board. I wasn't being critical in the negative sense, other than gaining a little insight into that field and how really important and imperative it is for the younger generation and up and coming to expand and self-determine and self-identify their needs in the process of decolonizing that field as well. It's very, very important. I just don't want that to be misunderstood. But I do recognize also, because I deal with social services and the field of social work, and it's the government is like really deeply involved. So, you know, there needs to be a movement, and you're part of that also, I understand, as it relates to organizing social workers.
Well, see, there's also something called the National Association of Black Social Workers. In our very mission statement, we speak to the fact that a black person who's not fighting for liberation is either uneducated or just, you know, has no compassion, you know, no empathy. So that organization has been in existence for 50 years. In fact, we're going to celebrate our 50th year anniversary in San Diego, California, in April. And at which I will be delivering in a workshop the 4 R's of African-centered social work, which I'm defining as rights, human rights, reparations, restitution, and rehabilitation. People can go no further than they are willing to pull themselves. And that is to say the healing, and you mentioned that earlier, the healing that we have to do it has to come from our thinking. It has to come from our psychologists, from our social workers, from our psychiatrists. It has to come from us in terms of the demand for reparations. So when you get people involved with human services, you get them involved with our healing, particularly around the question of rehabilitation, it begins to say, what is the whole purpose of rehabilitation? And that is to make a people whole. We have to figure out what does that mean, right? How do we make ourselves whole again after these years of being dissected in so many ways, socially, politically, economically? That is, in fact, the fight for self-determination, to make a people whole. So this conference is coming up in San Diego, and we're saying, you know, come on out. You know, unfortunately, this National Association of Black Social Workers hasn't done a good enough job around letting folks know you don't have to have a discipline, you don't have to have a degree in social work to be a member of the organization. If you're doing work to uplift the Black community, you can be a member. So hopefully we can start to do a better job in terms of our media outreach. I'm a former member of the New York chapter and a current member of the Philadelphia chapter. In fact, those two chapters in particular preceded the national founding of the National Association, because those organizations experienced their 50th anniversary on November 3rd and 4th. New York was on the 3rd and Philadelphia was on the 4th. So they're really in the forefront of the kind of thinking that has now driven the national organization. So that is to say that these thoughts are circulating throughout the country. We're going to have a vote for a national president, a new slate that's coming up in April, and I think that's going to be very telling in terms of how the organization is going to further align itself with the International Decade for People of Africa. So remember, we have three themes: recognition, we have justice, and we have development. And that's the themes that we should be running with, you know, in all our local cities, towns, counties. We should be bringing that discussion every place we are on the local level where we live.
You mentioned also, we're going to go into our break here with and have an extended show this evening, if you don't mind, Anaji. We've done our hour, but if we take a break now, he's going to allow us to go into the second half here and continue this conversation.
My pleasure.
Radio since 2008, providing new Black media for the masses.
Anaji, you there?
I'm here.
Brother, I'd like to really get tuned into your vision as relates to this decade. There's a lot of tentacles, there are a lot of activities going on. We have a lot of goals and a lot of things that just started. Now, you mentioned that there's this new declaration that's promulgated around the decade. Can you speak on it, and where can we find it, and how can we move that around as our rallying point and the mission and the vision of the decade, I assume?
Well, I just received notice of this development this week, and I haven't had a chance to read it to know exactly the content. All I know is that it gives us a platform for us to organize. That's what I know. Yeah. I know that all the work that's been done, it gives us a place to bring all these seemingly disparate aspects together under one banner. Similar to the declaration or for people, indigenous people, right? A number of years back, they were able to forge a document that's now being used internationally to talk about indigenous people, which gave them the ability to come together and have those conversations to raise their concerns and to set their goals into motion. Now, we, for the first time ever, are having the same platform to do that. So the extent or the power of that document is yet to be seen, and it's going to be determined by our ability to effectively organize and letting people know. You're saying, how do you make international dealings and activities relevant to people on the ground? Well, you have to talk to them, and you have to talk to them about what their needs are and what they want, and then let them know that we need their input into that document. So everything that is available to us gives us opportunity to bring people together. And you and I met through the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond. And they have this workshop on undoing racism. And they say very, plainly that the workshop is the means to an end, and the end is to organize. And as I say to my students, information is inadequate. You know, it's not enough. We have to have we have to have fact knowledge, and we have to also organize. So if you're not going to assume the task of organizing people and become an organizer, all you're doing is being, like you used the word, a gatekeeper, and that is so true. So we see the decade as a way of bringing these different movements together. We see this declaration for people of African descent as a way of starting to have, on an international level, when nations and regional bodies and non-governmental organizations come together, they call that a PrepCon, right? Preparation, conference for the big conference that brings everything together. So now we can mimic the United Nations structure and have community PrepCons. Right, that does two things. It brings people together. Number one, it lets them know about how the United Nations systems work, and it then puts us on track to engage in a liberation process like any other people have. If you go back to the 60s, looking at FLIMO, looking at PIGC, looking at any of the liberation struggles in Africa in particular, they had to bring their concerns to the forefront. And since I'm on that subject, let me also do a salute to one of my heroes out of Guinea-Bissau, Brother Amoco Cabral, who was actually murdered in the month of January, I think it was about 1973. Cabral was an agricultural engineer who actually went around to different villages and was able to compile that information and then show them the necessity for them to not just remain as an independent village, but in fact see themselves as being a colony of Portugal, and through that was able to launch a liberation struggle, a liberation movement that freed the state. So, I want to say that we are in a similar situation. We will not move any inch further without us having a commitment to organizing our people. So we see the declaration as being a vehicle for that to happen. We also see the vehicle of the International Decade for African People as a vehicle for that to happen. And people are responding, to the call, but it takes consistent effort, and it takes, consistent leadership. So we have to speak to our people on the street and bring them into leadership capacities. Not so much of us speaking for anyone else. They must speak for themselves, but we have to at least initiate the process.
On that note, we've had this discussion numerous times about getting the information out, and we need to share this, and we need to speak to people about it. But in reality, we need a media hub, a self-determined. Scotty Reed is in large part has done that as an independent agent pushing the agenda of black media. Now, as relates to CERD or the Human Rights Decade, you know, I had spoke to brothers that had been to Tehran and Press TV, and were speaking on the prospect of getting some assistance in launching Human Rights TV, where we could actually push human rights perspective from our narrative rather than it being overcome by other people's perception of what human rights really is. And so we really, really, really do need that communications hub. And to that point, you remember the proposal we had to try to aggregate data from a federal, state, and local level of civil rights and discrimination cases of whites, basically violations in all these areas of people activity based on the data that shows that discrimination is taking place, and it seems to be rooted in policies, and outcomes are driven by these policies. How can we find inside this decade a monetary source for funding to hub our communications to get that information spread, to support independent black media such as Scotty Reed, or to support the launching of a human rights TV to get the information out, or to support anti-racism media, you know, in conjunction with being dependent on mainstream media that's not going to get our story out, and we're still in that dependency state. Now, inside this decade, which I know there's going to be a lot of conferences, a lot of VIP things going on, a lot of funds allocated towards getting together, and then in certain parts, celebrations. Where does the prospect of finding funding to actually carry out some of our ideas and fulfill and interface our needs with the ability to address them, such as the operation of Black Talk Radio, for example? How do we get an infusion to push this agenda for this decade? Because we'll never again in our lifetime, and probably for many lifetimes and generations to come, have this opportunity to organize globally around this decade.
Was that directed towards me or Scotty?
Towards both of you, but really towards you, in the fact that, you know, you're dealing with NGOs. With Geneva, we have Guyana coming up, which I'd like you to speak to also. But where do we find funding to organize our organizing? You know, where could that be done?
I have to say that the first place to look is amongst ourselves. We have access to cable community stations throughout the country. There was, and you know, you're in the field of communication, you probably know this better than myself. Many of the companies that have secured contracts with different city agencies, city governments, had the obligation to provide public access. Both of us coming from New York, we know about Manhattan Neighborhood Network. We know that there are people who are putting out phenomenal programming. So there is a lot of program that's already taking place right here on Black Talk Radio. It's phenomenal shows, right? I don't get a chance to listen to many of the shows that's already on. So Adam Clayton Powell, you know, did a speech, "What's in your hand?" You know, what's in your hand? So we have to start with what's in our hand that's really available to us, and begin to bring people to these radio shows, to not just Race Treaty, but all the shows that happen on Black Talk Radio, and begin to use this as an education aspect in terms of bringing people together. So I would start with what we already have, and we have more than what we know. We just haven't sat down at the table and just kind of categorized and done an inventory on these things, right? You know, it starts with having a national conference on all these different black shows, people who are conscious, and having a conscience amongst ourselves to say, okay, how can we support each other? What ways can we create more cooperation so that we can have a presence that people can and see it, and then encourage our family members, you see, to listen to these shows and participating. So we only can move forward by organizing ourselves.
I like that, Najee. I like that a lot. You bring to mind for me something that I've been aware of for years as I've done a deep study on the internet, and something that is called white space, ironically. I had actually hashtagged something called Occupy White Space. White space shelf spectrum that we used to pick up with rabbit ears to get our television signal. That spectrum still exists, is active. The U.S. government stopped us from using that spectrum at first, though. Well, they sold out that same white space, which is basically Wi-Fi on steroids. It would be our international free internet. So while the FCC has divvied up this white space to these which belongs to the people, by the way, those that UHF, VHF is public controlled, was public controlled or represented space for the spectrum of radio transmissions for television, is actually Wi-Fi on steroids. They're keeping that secret, basically, and they're divvying it up, and they're going to charge folks to access, and they're about to control the internet. This era of freedom, we're having to have this discussion right now, could very well soon be coming to an end in itself. And as far as reliance on the UN, which is largely funded by the U.S. government, which is curtailing its funds for anything that goes against it, we've got some real serious, you know, reality clarification to deal with in bringing our issues together and reliant on ourselves. And you're right.
And this is why Jackson is so important.
Definitely important. I'd like to bring Scotty in real quick, though.
There's a new book out that's called Jackson Rising, The Struggle for Economic Democracy and Black Self-Determination in Jackson, Mississippi. And it's a book for all of us to get as current information on the different ways in which our people are organizing and inviting people to Jackson, which will be the last week in June of this year, where we are bringing all the conversation that you're having right now. That conversation is going to take place live on the ground in Jackson, and that's why it's so important for people to send the delegation to Jackson in June of this year.
Beautiful, beautiful. Scotty, did you have some comment to make?
Yes, I just wanted to chime in on the question you asked, and I agree with the Adam Clayton Powell statement about a bird in the hand. And so, you know, I had posted a message to our social media platform that we have in addition to Black Talk Radio Network, Digital Radio Network, and saying that if we don't get more support from the black community and specifically from those who listen, we had a 500,000 podcasts downloaded. That's not last year. That's not even including those who tuned in to the radio streams. So I said that we're in danger of shutting down after 2018, and we don't get more support, especially from those who are using the media. And so I've been think tanking with a couple of, you know, people that's on the network on how we can better raise funds. Now, this also brings us to a question of, I saw a person on YouTube who said that black people shouldn't ask other black people for money. The person's name isn't important, but I thought that was one of the most ridiculous statements, in saying that black people should ask white people for money. And we can't expect, and I'm not painting a broad, you know, brush of white people, because certainly we've had white allies and white people who have donated to our nonprofit, but we cannot expect those who oppress us to fund our liberation activities or to fund anything that we're doing towards self-determination. So I've been think-tanking with some of the fellas, you know, about coming up with sponsorship packages for businesses and what have you, and doing a membership drive for our social media, because I want Black Talk Radio Network to expand outside of just being online, one central location, but we need digital radio centers in our communities, you know, a physical building, just like a terrestrial radio that can become like a hub, not just a communications network for the local community, as Brother Najee was talking about. You know, we got to organize locally, run for local offices. We also had to develop our own local infrastructure outside of the government, you know, regulated spaces. And so that's something that I'm looking at as well. But it was something else that, yeah, we do have to protect the internet. All right. And so I was reading today that Facebook and Google and some of the big tech giants are coming together with this internet association that's made up with smaller companies and pushing Congress to make net neutrality law and not simply a policy that can be repealed or re-implemented with the, you know, partisan, whatever partisan administration comes into power, but that should be law. And so it seems that that's what's being pushed, and I agree that we should make this a campaign issue this year. It's 2018.
Occupy white space.
Yeah, it's 2018. And there is no reason, and there's tremendous support for net neutrality. A lot of people email, left comments for, you know, the FCC when it was going to make its net neutrality decision. So I feel like that's what direction we need to go in the short term, is putting pressure on Congress to make net neutrality legislative law. So those are my thoughts.
I want to add a point in support of the technology. I have a friend. He's a great consultant. He's a genius. He's a Six Sigma black belt. He told me, and it makes all the sense, that there is no business endeavor, no campaign, no building of any business activity without IT at the table. There's a tendency to have these great ideas and then figure we can call somebody up who knows how to build a website. But so as relates to the technology around what you're saying, and I love the idea of a black talk radio there in every local to help this communications around this decade on the same subjects and issues surrounding human rights and the local issues, but in a hub, that ability is there. Everything is able to be done technologically. We just have not brought the organizing capacity together at the table when we plan. So IT should always be at your planning table. It really should, because that way someone can interpret, you know, your wants and implement it from the onset. I'm getting back to this online data aggregation. My vision for that is the reason I read the law to eliminate racial discrimination, and I came to realize that the U.S. is not being held accountable because they don't have the data. So how do we acquire that data to put them on Front Street in all these areas of people activity where white supremacist oppression is taking place, racism is taking place, the impact is taking place, the victimhood is taking place, but we haven't gotten the data. Speaking of self-determination and doing it for ourselves, I'm saying, where can we get the funds where I can hire this genius to start web crawling and getting this data to present to the UN? Because it's really a hollow law of the Convention to Eliminate Racial Discrimination, because you can't enforce what you don't have in terms of the information on disparate impact and disproportionality. That's a data-driven information. And the U.S. is out of compliance because we know our folks is dying just reading the headlines. But we need to really bring IT in and jump ahead on this issue of occupying white space, but let technology also occupy in our planning. And I'm speaking really to you, Najee, and considering it because you're so many places and have so much of a dynamic that if IT ain't right there with you, it may disperse and weaken its impact. And I think the UN this decade is really important, and it does need that information hub.
without IT at the table. You can't hire a fix after the fact sometimes. You need that planning stage IT involvement. I have that proposal that went to the Ford Foundation, was taken over by the brother man in Europe, but the idea still remains that we, until we aggregate the data to show these complaints concerning discrimination and racism, is really ringing hollow on the international front, even though the U.S. has signed and ratified treaty to it. It's saying to you, hey, yeah, I signed, but you can't even prove it because you ain't even got the cards counted. And I'm keeping them behind my back. I'm not showing you my cards. And that's really how it's being played out. And we're running around playing the civil rights game, jackpot lawsuit lick, because that's all it's coming to. You can't prove, you know, intentionality behind the system that's built to oppress you. And so we do really need that avenue to the international courts. And it involves, at this juncture in the 21st century, IT, technology. We need to bring the technology to the game. That's where I'm at with that. Can I get a backing on that, Scotty Reed? Because that's, I know you understand where I'm coming from.
Most certainly. I agree with you, especially with the point that we have to have IT professionals that's working side by side, you know, with people like Anaje, who's out there. You know, it's one thing for Anaje to come on Friday nights and you know, and it's great because we're not getting it nowhere else, but for him to come in and give us a field report about, you know, what those people are doing in those spaces, some of the strategies and whatnot. But it would be even better if we can record that as it's happening and distribute it, you know, in media form out to the people in terms of the data, in terms of the oppression that we're facing. You know, we got like the citizen database killed by police. Who is doing their own tracking of all these police killings? But you know, he's looking at it from American citizens, and while he does put their racial classification, you know, he's including everybody in that. So I mean, anytime you go into a court of law or even a court of public opinion, you know, the data wins. Data wins. We can talk all day, you know, spew talking points, but it's the data that really speaks.
Well, you have to push that public opinion, though, because there's data out there right now, brother, and that is one that impacts me every day I think about it, and that is 64,000 black women are missing in this country. And I don't understand how to wrap my head around that, and I don't understand where to look to where there could be some conversation about that, much less something being done as it compiled data. We got population of black women disappearing and indigenous women. Let me be inclusive here. You know, it's a thing, but it isn't being dealt with by mainstream media, you know. And men dying, it's across the field. Organs, people dying, organs disappearing, all kind of things. I don't want to sound conspiratorial, but these things are a thing. So how do we speak to that and bring recognition, you know, to these issues, if not to the international arena, because we're not going to get that audience and remedy through this white supremacist system. That was what we do know. So I'm really looking forward to Jackson, and we need to really protect Jackson. We really need to really speak it up and support that. But the technology in and getting that word out, this is the modern day drum. Without it, we waiting on someone to show up from traveling, you know, to hear tale of. You know, we're right here and now, and we're not supporting each other. And by the way, African Americans represent what, the eighth richest country in the world? If we put all our money together economically, it represents a nation within a nation. You know, we're 90% consumers, produce nothing, control less than 1% of the land, control no industry. And so we have an opportunity to jump ahead with this technology field, this It's equal grounds out there. Well, it's our color.
There's an assumption here, or what's not being said, is that even with the information and even with the networks in place, the fundamental question is we have to control our own education. Because the reason why people are not coming together under these banners, because we send our children to other people's institutions, expect they're going to serve us, and they wind up serving themselves. So information is only as good as the education system in which it's contained in. We learned our lesson well in 1968 when the Ocean Hill Brownsville situation, where they gave the community the ability to run their own schools, and when they changed the curriculum and decided to make it African-centered, they called in the National Guard and said, "Oh no, we didn't think you were serious about educating your children." So information, fine, but information is subjected to the education and intent. And that's really what is at the heart of many of our problems. We don't control education. So as Carter G. Woodson said in 1953, miseducation of the Negro. And all you have to do is just change a few words here and there, and the same situation goes today, because we don't control our institutions. And that's why ICRON has been and will continue to fight for the survival of historically Black colleges and universities. We have a few conferences coming up, one in February, and I don't have it at my fingertips. One, I can tell you next week, one in February and another one in May. So we have to save the institutions we have first. Yes, we want more and we need more, but we have to start with what we have and protect with what we have. And the historically Black colleges and universities are the closest thing that we have to Article 27 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, in terms of people, you know, minorities, be it linguistic, be it ethnic, be it racial, be it I said religious, those communities have a right, you know, to have their own community life and run their own affairs. So that's the closest thing that we have to it. It's not exactly, because they have to, you know, adhere to, you know, federal guidelines, so forth and so on, but we're losing more institutions than we have to. So we have to begin to see how important those institutions are. And I'd like to have Brother Fareed Muhammad, who's the chief NGO representative for ICRON, who's leading that effort, to come on and give us some more direct information about that. So,
well, Brother Amaje, I have some questions about that. Now, in terms of HBCUs, HBCUs are financially out of the reach of the bulk of our people. And I found that out when I went with my daughter to apply to a HBCU. And we could not afford that. I mean, I could have went into debt, and she could have went into debt with all these student loans and what have you. But the Obama administration did some harm in the Pell Grants and eliminating Pell Grants and stuff like that, to where even the HBCUs are unaffordable for the bulk of our people. And that's a shame, because I understand that, you know, they do educate a lot of people from poor communities, but it's still for the little bit that they are educating, there are far more who just can't simply afford to go. And then I also want to point out that Ajit Pai of the FCC that we just got through talking about, that's trying to kill net neutrality, he went to Howard University. You got Senator Kamala Harris, another HBCU product who supports modern day slavery and human trafficking. So I feel like we have to get to our people while they young, in the elementary school, in the junior high. We have to control that education, because it seems like HBCUs are just producing more capitalists and black people who want to be a part of the system.
So Scotty, you speaking of education, I want to pipe in on that, and I there's a missing term here.
But let me finish this part right here, Robin. Robin, let me finish this part. Yeah. It goes back again to something Minaj talked about. Local politics include the local school board. Now, I don't live in a predominantly black county. I can't tell you right now the makeup of Charlotte Mecklenburg County and their school board. But in places like Atlanta, places like Detroit, places like New York City, where we have numbers, as he was speaking about, then there's no excuse in my mind that we should not be in control of these school boards and therefore in control of the curriculum. And I leave it there.
I absolutely agree on multiple ends. And like I said, though, we keep saying, well, we need to educate our people. And every time I think of that, I think of assimilation. I think of the byproduct of assimilation. I think of the experience of transforming our people into boules, where it's a high class, some sorority or fraternity, as opposed to the decolonizing process, which involves education of the facts and national search, not to be placed in a white supremacist system, but to be freed to be self-determined. And if there's not a process, decolonizing process, we're just doing that cookie cutter assimilation process. And yes, the black colleges should be the ones leading that. But if, again, you know, we can pay taxes to the government. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is my charge. Any conscious black adult who's not involved with supporting either with their money or with their brains or with their talent or with their skills, some youth program, some rights of program, is overlooking their responsibility as a parent. And you don't have to be a physical parent to be a parent. If you're a social parent, that's that. You know, we're talking about education and we're talking about controlling the education system. Well, you know, we need to start Saturday schools. Go back to the African Free School Movement. There are many things that we can do that we're not doing. So, I saw our ability to actually create institutions and which really, not even institutions, yes, but just create places of us coming together, having these conversations and seeing how we can attend to the mental, physical, and spiritual needs of our people. So I have faith in our people that we're going to see ourselves through. Yes, it is quite difficult looking at all these statistics, but I figure, like, if we got out of chattel slavery, well, we're in the new Jim Crow slavery now, but we're going to get out of the new Jim Crow slavery. So with certainly a terrible admission, in war there's always casualties. We are at war, and once we know that, we have to see ourselves through from one battle to the next so I again come back from Geneva very inspired, seeing the young people there and what they were saying and what they were doing made me feel that, you know, our struggle for our liberation is still alive and well, and we're going to continue to organize ourselves and continue to educate ourselves and to begin to break down the mistrust, you know, in ourselves that's stopping us from, you know, being more cooperative. You know, we just finished leaving another, I don't know how many years Kwanzaa's been in existence, you know, with the principles. You know, the principles of unity and self-determination, collective work and responsibility and cooperative economics and purpose and Kawumba and faith, you know. So the fact that that cultural institution is still flourishing and still going forward, we're starting to change the mindset of our people to interact with each other in different ways. I can give a reference to a school here in Philadelphia, Imhotep, you know, an African-centered school that is teaching people that they are African and their careers need to be geared towards solving the problems in our community. That's one but we have to continue to build those institutions. And those of us who are conscious can and see what has to be done, continue to put those things forward. And certainly, you two gentlemen have been leaders in this respect, in terms of Scotty being the founder of Black Talk Radio, Robin, you being the founder of Race Treaty. You know, I love and respect both of you, and know that our work is to continue to bring other people into the fold. So I'm inspired.
Brother, you inspire me. You're going internationally with that message, and you take the time to present on this radio show. And I want to thank you also for carrying Race Treaty for the last year. You came on as co-host and actually took it on and let me have a respite and some transitions in my personal life also. And I love you, brother, and I appreciate that. And I want to always keep our focus on this decade and mirror white supremacy as an illegal a structure that's imposing global harm as a crime against humanity. And I'm waiting for the day where we can take to the international courts this issue as relates to the oppression and the disparate impact and disproportionality of my people being traumatized, and all peoples of color being traumatized, including poor whites now, being traumatized by this system of white supremacy. On that note, we're about to end this show this evening. I want to call into attention the Jackson calling that's coming up. And also, I would like you to speak before we end, Najee, on the Guyana gathering and what prospects this has in pushing the agenda forward in terms of the decade and the convention to eliminate racial discrimination, sir.
Well, the government of Guyana has stepped forward to assemble the African genius around the world, and they have around seven different areas, the same areas we've been talking about: education, health, communication, economics in terms of business, IT, all the things we've been talking about on this show tonight are in fact some of the areas in which they are creating a place for African genius to come together and look at, solve, and move back into their respective countries to work together. So this international current that has really kind of had the impetus out of Durban in 2001 has continued and is continuing. And the more we get together, the more we find the thinking and the actions that's going to make a difference. As Frederick Douglass says, power never conceded without a demand. It never did. It never will. It may be a moral struggle. It may be a physical struggle, but it must be a struggle, because where there is no struggle, there is no progress. And we are fighting through the hegemony of Eurocentric thinking, and we're fighting through these institutions. And even, yes, there are those, as Scotty pointed out, who have gone to historically black college institutions and have come out and be those who are collaborators with those who are against our interests. And at the same time, there's many who have not, right? I can, last show, for those who you're listening, might have listened to this last Friday show, I had Dr. Ray Winbush on, right? Also a graduate of an institute black historically black Christian, and is taught in many of them, right, and knows it inside and out. So let us not count that which we don't have. Let us count what we do have. And when we do that, we're able to bring them together for a cumulative effect that's going to make the difference, because that's where our power is. We have to always recognize where our power lies, and it's with those who have our interests at heart. And yes, there will be collaborators. And no, we don't control the curriculums of the historically black college and university, but we could. There's one black president in Texas who decided to eliminate the football team. And of course, he had a lot of opposition and pushback towards that. But guess what he's doing with the football field? He's growing food. And the same football field is selling the food back to the Cowboys. So we have to take up Booker T. Washington's agenda. We have to be self-reliant. We have to be able to build our houses. We have to be able to manufacture our cars. We have to move from demystification into move from education into self-reliance. That's where we're going to see any progress, because when we can employ our own people, supplying the needs, mental, transportation, communication, when we start fulfilling our own needs, we'll have the collective will and confidence to encourage others. You know, nothing succeeds like success. So we're going to continue forward in that fashion.
That's beautiful, man. There's another element to Guyana too, and it's so appropriate concern, that element in the liberation of Black psychologists. And what's the Black revolutionary's name from Guyana? You know who I'm speaking of?
Rodney. You're talking about Rodney.
Yes. So I had a thing with his spirit recently, and him being in Guyana and his unkept grace, and how he laid that his analysis of the white mind also. It's so appropriate that the possibility of bringing those groups in that mindset there, that's going to be very, very powerful. Very powerful. Najee, do you have any more for this evening, man? I look forward to your continued hosting of the show and the great guests that you have and the more work that we have to do.
Right now, two of the young persons that I met in Geneva, one fight, and another one, sister from Virgin Islands, they will become co-hosts of the show. And more we want young people to assume these airways, because that's where it is. And we have to let their genius be known. I also see that my daughter is listening, Sister Meheret from Etria. And I don't know if you can unmute her phone, and she might like to say a few words from Seattle, Washington. She's at 206, the 206 number. I don't know if you can unmute her. Meheret?
I'm here, Baba.
Hello, my daughter. How are you?
I am feeling very blessed to hear your voice and to listen to the wisdom and inspiration that you're sharing.
You know, I didn't even know that you had sent me something, and I was going through some folders and I saw this conference that you were in, and you were talking about education of the Black child. So if you will share with the listening audience, you know, who are you, what do you do, and the work that you're doing with raising beautiful Black African children.
Oh, I was not prepared to speak, but my name is Meheret Mahanzal. I am originally from Eritrea, and I came here 27 years ago as a teenager with my family. I've lived in Seattle for all that time, and most of my work is around education as well as social work and just social service. I want to be part of a world that shows our children that they're loved, that they're affirmed, and uplifted as children of African descent. I have four children of my own, and I work mostly around early childhood education as well as parent education and empowerment. That's it.
Well, it's so much more to that, but certainly we can accept that. And we also have another caller from New York, and we'd like that person to introduce themselves and say what's on their mind. New York City?
Brother Anaj, they may just be listening. As we have some people who prefer to listen by phone rather than the stream.
Okay. So, you know, this is the first time I had spoken to my daughter this year, and I'm so happy to have her on the show. And we have to have her back where she give her a little bit more time to be prepared to talk about the phenomenal work that she's doing. As a conscious African woman who has adopted me as her father, and I have adopted her as my daughter. And that's a story that we are going to tell the world, and people will be thoroughly amazed about this love, this Pan-African love that has reached across the ocean. So I guess that's it for now. Robin, any closing remarks? Scotty, any closing remarks?
No, I love you, brother, what you do. We claim in 2018, by the way.
Well, I just want to thank you and Robin both for being part of Black Talk Radio Network as we enter into our 10th year of broadcasting and providing censor-free Black media and uplifting Black voices who not only discuss the problems but offer solutions. And so I just want to thank you, brothers, for being part of the Black Talk Radio broadcasting family.
Well, all I can say is Harambe.
Hotep, signing off.
All right, blessings.
Peace. We'll be right back.